Mr. Condren relates.
So in many ways, I feel that I'd gone to China and lived for a number of years in China in what were perhaps the good old days or the best days. And other people have expressed the same opinion. And I must say, on the whole, if I take my years in China into account, I learned an awful lot. I continue to read, of course. I learned a lot about life. I worked there. I taught for several years at university in Peking, and I liked the students very much. They were a very hard-working lot. Got along with them quite well.
What were you teaching?
English. I taught English at the university there.
English language?
English language, yeah.
Or literature?
No, language. I don't think I'd be qualified to be touched on literature, but I didn't teach it as such. They had people more eminently qualified than me to do that. And but it was quite enjoyable. I grew to have a very great and deep love and respect for the Chinese people. I inevitably ran into bureaucracy.
In what form?
Well, in all forms of, in all organizational forms, China is, or was, and probably still is, run very much by bureaucrats. And I think any totalitarian system, if you like, or one-party government, it's almost inevitable that you're eventually dealing at the middle and certainly at the middle echelons with bureaucrats. And
did you have any unpleasant experiences?
I had quite a number of unpleasant experiences, yes, but on the whole, nothing drastic, because I was quite safe in the fact that I was a foreigner and so on. You know.
Can you give some instances of the unpleasant experiences that you had?
Well, when I was at the university, this must have been, let me see, 1956, 57, thereabout. I had a Chinese girlfriend, one of the students. She wasn't one of my students. She was, I think she was only in the second year. I only taught third and fourth year student, you know, as the level increased. And we started to see one another, on and off. I sometimes saw her at weekends. Her family was in Peking. And I suppose we'd been going out together for a few months, 4 or 5 months and so on, when her family started putting pressure on her. Because her father worked as he wasn't a communist. He was originally from Hong Kong. He'd been a businessman, and she had been brought up in Hong Kong, so she spoke fairly good English anyway. And anyway, her family, her mother was all right. I visited them, her home several times, and I got along quite well with her mother and the rest of her family. But I think the father was a bit anti-foreign and didn't want his... The Chinese are... on the whole, quite xenophobic in this way. Not just in China, even in Chinese communities outside of China. And I think he was a bit opposed to it. And I think the university also, although I don't know how far it was their fault, or maybe he put pressure on the authorities. But anyway, to cut a very long story short, they broke it up. They managed to break it up. And she decided she couldn't take it anymore. So... among other things, they told her that she shouldn't have anything to do with me because I was working for British intelligence. That the tiger never changes its stripes and various things like this, you see, which annoyed me. You know, because I felt that the Chinese should have trusted me in that way, but. They either didn't, or they certainly gave the appearance that they didn't. And another nasty thing was that they told her all these things, you know, about me. I was this, that, and the other thing. But they told her that she couldn't tell me anything about this because it was what they called an internal matter, which foreigners weren't supposed to know about. And if she told me these things, then action could be taken against her. She, of course, told me these things, but it tied my hands because I couldn't then go back and argue with them because I wasn't even supposed to know. And they never approached me on it, you see. They wouldn't do that. The pressure was all on her. And finally, it became unbearable, and she just sort of broke down and decided that, you know, we couldn't continue. So at that point, I decided, well, if that's the way the people at the university see me, then I no longer want to remain in the university. And in fact, I no longer want to remain in China. And you cannot exist in China without an organization of some sort. Everybody is part of an organization, right down to the simple town dweller living. You know, you're in the street committee, or you're part of some organization, or if you're working somewhere, you're obviously in an organization, or school, or university, or company, or factory, or whatever. Well, the organization under whose auspices I went to China initially were the Chinese Red Cross, obviously, you know. So they were my organization, you see. So I went and had a talk with them. They, of course, didn't believe me at first that this had happened. Whether they probably still don't believe it to this day. But it did happen. And I felt that this was an infringement on my personal liberty, and that it was un-Marxist, it was on everything as far as I was concerned. It just wasn't the way to treat people. So I told the Red Cross what I was going to do. And they said I couldn't. Well, just a moment. I said I was going to, you see. So a few days later, I made an appointment to see the director of the university. And I went and explained to him what had happened. He, of course, denied everything. And I said, well, you can deny it if you like, but I'm telling you that it happened. And because of this, I'm resigning from university. And he sort of laughed, you know, and he said, oh, comrade, he said, I think this was in Chinese, this conversation, because he didn't speak much English. And anyway, he laughed and he said, comrade, he said, no one can resign in China. You can't. You can't resign. It's a bit like Japan. You can't resign. And I said, you just watch me. I said, I'm resigning. So I got my few bits and pieces together, and I hired a couple of pedicabs, put my bits and pieces on, and rode my bike out through the gate, and that was the end of my university days.
Did you approach the British Embassy?
No, I had up to that point nothing to do with the British Embassy. I hadn't contacted them because I was classified by the Admiralty as being a deserter. Okay? Because, for very simple reasons, when I decided to stay behind in Korea, the Admiralty were faced with a bit of a dilemma as far as my records went. They had four options. Okay? Killed in action. Wasn't. Missing, presumed killed. Wasn't. Prisoner of war. No longer a prisoner of war. The only classification they could fit me in under was on the run. I'm not sure, my discharge certificate there somewhere, there's a big R on it. It means you're on the run. I wasn't a deserter. I'd never deserted from anything in my life. But that was the only classification they could put down.
You were basing your status on the agreement at the armistice?
Yeah, but they obviously weren't. So for that reason, I thought, you know, if I approach the British Embassy and so on, it might prove to be a bit of an embarrassment for people, because if officially I'm classified as a deserter, then obviously it must affect their attitude towards me, so I just avoided it. I didn't. So that answers that question. No, I was still sort of under the Red Cross. And then when I left there, they had the Red Cross had a little hostel place in Peking where I went, and I stayed there because I told the Red Cross that I decided to come back to Britain. I was giving it up. I was just I'd enough. And they were a bit concerned about this. I suppose, you see, again, it was the question of face involved. Because, let's face it, let's say if I had sort of come back at that point, I would have left China still having a great love for China and the Chinese. My ideas basically hadn't changed. My ideas, I suppose, in many ways had been reinforced, but I had become anti-bureaucratic. I saw that communists or not, that they work like bureaucrats anywhere, But if I had come back at that time, as far as the Chinese are concerned, the propaganda on this side might have affected them. In other words, here you have this chap, who's gone to live in the great socialist China, you see, and all the rest of it, but who decides to leave and come back and face a possible prison sentence as a deserter in a horrible capitalist country rather than remain in a free and enterprising socialist country. So propaganda-wise, the Chinese would lose political face. You understand me? But I wasn't particularly worried about it, and I decided to come back.
Was it easy to get back?
Well, they couldn't refuse me permission. If I wanted to leave, I could leave. Oh yeah, it was nice.
So no obstacles were put in front of me?
No, I could have come back. No question.
What about on the British side?
On the British side, I take my chances. But I was willing to do that. I felt that I had a case, that I had done nothing illegal or immoral, Fortunately, and I was told this afterwards by intelligence people here, because who interviewed me when I came back, not one man in the prisoner of war camp had a bad word to say about me in the camp. And in fact, some of them praised me rather highly for my efforts in trying to improve conditions and so on.
Was this naval intelligence? What did they want to know from you?
Well, that's another story. I can tell you that's a separate sort of story, but I can go on to that in a moment. But anyway, if I had come back to face the music, if you like, I didn't mind. Just even, again, it's a question of... you see, to my mind, if I had come back, first of all, I don't believe that I ever did anything wrong. But at the same time, I could understand why people might think that I had. I could see their point of view, okay? In some ways, valid, okay? They might have considered I was a traitor, or I had let down the Royal Marines, or, various reasons. Understandable. But in my own mind, I'd never harmed anyone. What I had done is tried to survive and try to help others survive as far as I could. That was all. I'd conducted myself in a reasonable and honourable way. So it didn't hold any great terrors for me. I mean, if you go through 3 years in a prisoner of war camp under those conditions, the prospect of prison or jail sentence is nothing. What is it? It's nothing. And I was so irate by the way I had been treated by bureaucracy, not by the Chinese, it was purely bureaucrats, that's what I decided to do. Anyway, I got rid of what few possessions I had, books and radio and things like that. I just gave everything away, And there was one of the American chaps, who had also stayed behind. He was studying at Peking University at that time. And I used to see him on and off. And he came to see me one night, and he said, if you're going back, in a month or two, he said, why don't we just go and we'll have a last holiday, because I had a little bit of money, the things I'd sold and things. And he had a little bit saved up, so we decided to go on holiday to a place called Bay Daho, which is up on the Pohai Gulf. It's quite a well-known, used to be a very popular resort with the old colonial people when they were there, and the missionaries and people, they always used to go there for the holidays. So we went up there, we stayed there for about 3 weeks or a month or something. And that was where I met my wife. I met her, she was on holiday as well. And so later on, anyway, to cut a very long story short, we got married. And I stayed in China for a few more years. So that was that.
When you came back, the question I asked you before was, what did the naval intelligence want to know from you?
Yes, well, before I came back, after I got married, because I told my wife at that point when we got married that my intention was eventually, you know, to come back to Britain. I wasn't staying in China. And that was understood, you know, before we got married. Well, marriage was another thing. That was a little bit funny, too, but never mind. So that was quite all right. And then my son was born about a year later. He was born 1960. And then when he was about two and a half, I decided, I had actually decided before that, about a year before that. And I had made application to leave China and come back. But then again, bureaucracy, and this time from the Red Cross, they told me that, well, they said, you're free to leave any time you want, comrade, of course, you know. But they said, your wife and child can't leave because we consider them to be Chinese citizens. My wife is a Chinese citizen. Because my son was born there, he's considered a Chinese citizen. So that, again, is another catch-22 situation. You can go, sure, yes, anytime you want, but your wife and child can't come. So, fortunately, by this time, I understood the Chinese mind, if you like. I know that sounds a little bit perverse in a way, but they do see things and they look at things in a different way. And so I didn't get angry or anything. I just said, thank you very much, you know. I feel that you're making a mistake here, but, you know, I'll take it to a higher level, you see. And it took me 18 months before I got permission.
For the three of you to leave?
For the three of us to leave. And I employed a number of tactics to bring that about. One of them being, I wrote a very long letter to my father. And I didn't send it through the mail. Someone brought it out and gave it to him. And I asked him to copy the letter word for word in his own handwriting and send it to John Lai, who was Prime Minister. And he did this. And I said a number of things in the letter, but what I did is I emphasized two main points that I knew the way the Chinese look at things were significant. The Chinese have a very great love and respect for children and for old people. Traditionally, they have this, and they still have. So in the letter, I emphasized, I said, that, you know, I had my father say that he was an old man and the doctors told him that he didn't have long to live, which is lies, absolute lies. And before he died, there was, two things he wanted to see before he passed off, shuffled off the mortal coil. One was his little grandson whom he'd never seen, and one was his daughter-in-law, and the other was the son that he hadn't seen, and so on, so on, so on, you see. And I was almost in tears writing this letter, you see. But apparently it had the desired effect, because we knew someone in Peking who knew one of Zhou Enlai's secretaries. And he told us, he said, that Zhou Enlai hadn't actually read the letter, but he read a summary of the letter he must have had millions of letters. So he read a summary from one of his secretaries. And Zhou Enlai's immediate reaction was, well, the chap wants to leave with his wife and son. Let him leave, what's the problem? Boom, just like that. And so he finally told us that we could leave, and I made arrangements very hurriedly, and I was helped by the Red Cross, they helped me. And about 3 days later, I left China. I think two suitcases, a wife and a 2.5-year-old son, and that was it. Oh, and £30 sterling. Because I had a lot, I had quite a bit of Chinese money saved up, but they don't let me change £30. So I got the 30 quid and I just gave the rest away. We just got on a Russian Ilyushin, I think it was Ilyushkin or something, plane, and that was it, we were out. So we eventually got back here. There was a little bit of thing in the press. The press was all there, meeting, got the story and whatnot. And eventually got up to Scotland. We stayed in Scotland for about 3 months, I suppose. And it was a very bad winter, 62, 63, I don't know if you recall. A lot of snow, and it was very, very cold, especially up in Scotland, and no central heating. But we'd been up there for a couple of weeks, and I went out for a walk one morning. And I was just walking up the road, and a car stopped beside me, and the chappie got out. I thought, what's this, you see? And anyway, it transpired he was from Stirling CID, because I was staying at Alloa at that time, my sister's place. And he showed me his ID and explained who he was and so on, and told me that the people in there and at the Admiralty were very keen on talking to me, mainly about to settle up details of people I had actually seen being killed or people I had buried that they hadn't fully documented records on. You know. Well, I said, fair enough, that's quite all right, no problem. So they sent me a ticket and so on. They paid my expenses and they came down. They said it would just be probably one day they'd talk to me for an hour or two, and that was it, you see. So I didn't mind. So I came down and went to the old war office down in Whitehall and met the... There was five gentlemen there, and they never actually told me who they were. One, I think, was a psychiatrist. There was one who was... ostensibly by the Foreign Office, but I think he was an intelligence. He was a China expert, spoke Chinese, and I later became very good friends with him. His family and my family, we became quite good friends.
Who was he?
Foreign Office, worked in the Foreign Office.
What was his name?
I won't give his name. Well, he gave me a false name anyway, in the first place. And it was a few months later before he actually told me his real name, when I sort of got to know him. So there were obviously intelligence people, and I think one was a psychiatrist and so on. Four or five. But they probably didn't know what to expect, and I sort of didn't know what to expect. But they asked me the usual questions, you know, about people I'd seen and this, and I was able to provide them with whatever information I had. And then from there, we got into other discussions, you know, as to basically, you know, why I had decided to stay and so on. You see, because I suppose from an intelligence point of view, if I wasn't a total and complete madman, what had made me decide to do this crazy thing? I mean, from their point of view. And I suppose also from the military point of view, you know, people being... taken prisoner because no one knew what was going to happen then, if there'd be more conflict between China and the West, and you know. And probably they were very keen to understand what made me tick. And so we get into all sorts of discussions about China, about politics, and of course I'm a bit outnumbered here, and these are all men who know the stuff. They're clever men, you know, no fools. But I suppose the basic political point of view was different. Although they understood a lot, some of them understood a lot about Marxism. They had obviously read it up, and again from their own point of view, but I had a different point of view. And it ended up, I was there for about 5 days, just talking. Well, in the morning we talked and had lunch, and then we continued in the afternoon.
And were they trying to get information about China from you?
Not really. What information could they get about China from me? I mean, that they couldn't get themselves or from embassy people. No, it was just basically how I'd got on and what I'd worked out, what I'd done, and a lot of it dealt on how I thought and how I saw the Chinese point of view. And But I just, as far as I could, told the truth, as far as I see it. I like China. I like the Chinese people. I didn't think that the Chinese as a nation wanted war. I thought that they had enough to handle on the, you know, enough problems of their own without that. I didn't think they were a warlike people. I disagreed with the then current domino theory. I just, it didn't make sense to me at all. I also disagreed with the idea of this massive monolithic block, which they saw at the time as a Sino-Soviet bloc. I told them, as far as I thought, there was a lot of contradictions between the two. And of course, as it inevitably turned out, there was a break in relations. But at that time, they didn't see it that way. And, you know, we argued and discussed a bit. And at the end of it all, I told them that I still... all right, I'd had a few bad experiences in China, but it's not the system or anything. It's bureaucracy, you know. And that I felt that the Chinese communists were doing probably as the best they could under the circumstances. They had massive problems. I mean, it's a terrific and complex problem to solve. But I did feel that of all the people that had been around at that particular point in history, the late 40s, that the communists were probably the only people with the organization and the ability and the wherewithal to do anything for China. And I felt that that if nothing else, that history would eventually recognize that the communists had, if nothing else, if they did nothing else, that they'd recognize two great things that the communists had done. They'd made China a nation, and they'd freed the Chinese women. And to me, that's enough. Even if they did nothing else. I don't know if I was right or if I was wrong. I don't know. Perhaps if China had, you know, taken another road, it might have worked out its problems. We don't know. We just don't know. It would be pure hypothesis to set up anything and to say, well, this could have happened. But anyway, all in all, it all went quite well. And I quite enjoyed it, and I think they probably enjoyed it. They, as you say, they might have been trying to find out things about China, but I honestly don't think so. There was nothing much I could tell them. I mean, from an intelligence point of view, I mean, what the hell? They have better people there themselves to analyze these things. I just lived as an ordinary Chinese lives. I didn't live apart. I lived with the Chinese.
Were you at any stage threatened with a court martial?
No. Ah. That was something I meant to explain earlier on. After I got married, you see, I decided that what I'd do is... well, of course, eventually intending to come back to Britain, I had to get British nationality for my wife. So I went to the embassy, and as a matter of fact, the gentleman with whom I dealt with at the embassy was later to become Sir Edward Yun, who was the governor of Hong Kong, who died a few months back, or a couple of months ago. Youde, Edward Yun. Very, very nice man, spoke very good Chinese, understood China very, very well. I think at the time he was second secretary or something, British Embassy. But he was the man I mainly dealt with, and he was very nice, very helpful, very friendly. Very, very friendly. Made all the arrangements, and in due course, my wife was given a British citizenship. I had to register the marriage then as well. Never seen a Chinese wedding certificate. Massive thing. Anyway, I had to register. It had all to be translated and whatnot.